Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. A Democratic victory last night in California's recall election, leaving Gavin Newsom's job secure as the state's governor. It's also a warning shot for Republicans ahead of the midterm elections of 2022 and possibly a roadmap for Democrats to continue racking up victories in these times. The New York Times writes this, quote, considered a bellwether for the 2022 midterm elections, the recall outcome came as a relief to Democrats nationally. The polls showed that the recall was consistently opposed by some 60% of Californians. Surveys over the summer suggested that likely voters were unenthusiastic about Newsom. As the election deadline approached, however, his base mobilized. Democrats proving they can drive enthusiasm and turnout in a race framed as a referendum on pandemic restrictions, the kind President Joe Biden has now long championed, and the kinds of things GOP leaders continue to forcefully and vocally fight. Late last night, in a victory speech, Governor Newsom hailing a win for science, not to mention a win for all the priorities that have dominated the national Democratic agenda in recent weeks.
We said yes to science. We said yes to vaccines. We said yes to ending this pandemic. We said yes to people's right to vote without fear of fake fraud or voter suppression. We said yes to women's fundamental constitutional right to decide for herself what she does with her body and her fate and future. We said yes to diversity. We said yes to inclusion. We said yes to pluralism. We said yes to all those things that we hold dear as Californians, and I would argue as Americans.
And of the central Democratic policies that Governor Newsom outlines there, polling suggests that coronavirus was the critical one driving voters to the ballot box. From the Washington Post reporting, quote, according to early exit polls, the pandemic was the top issue for California voters. 3 in 10 said it was the most important in determining who they'd vote for. Nearly 70% of voters supported school mask requirements, according to early exit polls, an opinion that appears to favor Newsom. Polls have shown that voters, more than any other issue, fear the pandemic after experiencing a sense of an open economy briefly this summer. That has boosted Newsom's standing significantly in recent weeks. But in what should perhaps serve as a more alarming sign for Republicans, it's also worth noting that in the home stretch of the race, with top Republican challenger Larry Elder parroting Donald Trump's baseless talking point about phony voter fraud and a rigged election, Governor Newsom and President Biden framed the race in even starker terms, stressing that a win for Newsom would represent a repudiation of Trumpism.
You either keep Gavin Newsom as your governor, or you'll get Donald Trump. It's not a joke. Republican governor blocking progress on COVID-19, who is also anti-woman, anti-worker, a climate denier, who doesn't believe in choice. The choice should be absolutely clear.
We may have defeated Donald Trump, but we have not defeated Trumpism. Trumpism is still on the ballot in California, and that's why it's so important, not just for all of us here, to send a statement all across the United States of America that Trumpism has no place here and Trumpism will be defeated all across the United States of America, because we're better than that.
Wow. New York Times weighing in on the success of Newsom and Biden's crystal clear messaging there in the final stretch. Quote, the recall does offer at least one lesson to Democrats in Washington ahead of next year's midterms. The party's pre-existing blue and purple state strategy of portraying Republicans as Trump-loving extremists can still prove effective with the former president out of office. The possibility that elder-style figures could win primaries in more competitive states alarms many establishment-aligned Republicans as they assess the 2022 landscape. Nominees too closely linked to Trump or laden with personal baggage or both could undermine the party's prospects in states like Georgia, Arizona, Missouri, and Pennsylvania that will prove crucial to determining the control of the Senate. And that is where we start today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Former Republican strategist Steve Schmidt is here. Also joining us, A.B. Stoddard, associate editor and columnist for Real Clear Politics. And Sam Stein's back, White House editor for Politico and MSNBC contributor. Steve, I have a million questions. You worked for Arnold Schwarzenegger's reelect, not the recall. But I want to ask you about this nationalized dynamic, really in the last 10 to 12 days of this race, with Elder grabbing onto what he might have thought was a life preserver, but turned out to be concrete boots, this claim of voter fraud, this Trump-cloned message that may sound popular on their right-wing media, but reeks of losing. What do you think happened here?
Well, this has always been a project of extremists from day one. It's been a meld of reality show theatrics with Caitlyn Jenner all the way to Larry Elder. And what we know about this is an abuse of a part of California's unique system of governance that came into being during the progressive era, where the state was fabulously corrupt and the people needed a mechanism to be able to recall a governor who was too deeply in the pockets of the substantial special interests that ran the state. And so the threshold for the number of signatures you need to get to start this are astonishingly low. And that's something that should be redressed now that we know what the outcome of this is. But at any rate, this was an act of vandalism. This had nothing to do with the public good. This had nothing to do with any legitimate complaint of act of misconduct or act of corruption. It was all about nonsense, and it was the province of this blend of Trump extremism. It was an incursion into the bluest state in the country with a population of 38 million people to see if they could arouse enough apathy on the Democratic side to turn out against the fanaticism of the Trump side, which would certainly, in the name of their leader, in the name of its vessel, Larry Elder in this case, swarm to the polls to depose Gavin Newsom. And what we found out was the Democratic vote was not apathetic, and it showed up and turned out to repudiate this. And secondly, there was no swarm. There was no constituency. What you have is a minority of the vote that, though it does have fanaticism on its side, though it resorts frequently to intimations of violence through much of the country, and certainly in the state of California, is an abject minority by view of the total population. And so that sets up this contest. And what I would say with regard to the New York Times talking about, it's not about Democrats trying to portray Republicans as Trump-loving extremists, right, as to assign them a quality that doesn't otherwise exist. In fact, they are Trump-loving extremists. And that's exactly what Larry Elder was. And that's why he went down in flames in the still golden state of California.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow up real quickly, Steve, I mean, that, like, just ask Liz Cheney, right? She was purged from Republican leadership, not for not being far enough to the right on cultural issues, on fiscal issues, on foreign policy. You can't get any farther to the right than Liz Cheney, but for not believing in the fanaticism of the GOP. And I wonder, I'd like your thoughts on how that now bleeds, that the GOP brand is indifferent to death and suffering, including of children, in the most unvaccinated states in this country, led by largely Republican governors. There are crammed pediatric wards. There's not just indifference, but defiance of the few things you can do to keep kids safe in schools, mask mandates, vaccine mandates for teachers. I don't think that Republicans learn anything when they lose, especially with this rigged playbook. But what do you think Democrats can learn from the struggles that Republicans are going to have in the suburbs with their current indifference to death and dying?
I think what Democrats need to understand is that this is zero sum, and they are combating nihilism. They are not debating opponents who have good faith ideas that are just different than theirs. What we're witnessing in the states is some of the greatest acts of public immorality and irresponsibility, literally, in the entirety of the history of the country, including indifference to what will be the children's pandemic, the suffering of children who otherwise wouldn't die, wouldn't get this disease, wouldn't wind up on respirators if there was any sense of responsibility. But what we're seeing is a bidding war, not unlike something that you might see play out in Saudi Arabia, where the princes compete to see who will be the crown prince and the named successor, the heir to the MAGA empire. And the two leading candidates right now in a bidding war to the bottom of stupidity, of banality, of irresponsibility, of grotesquery, are the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, and the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott. And they have built this culture of extremism, not to gain majority opinion, but to excite, to entice, and to intoxicate the fantasies of the extremists who dominate the early stages of the GOP money game, who dominate the early stages of the activist game, and who will shape the outcomes in the early primary states. What they hope is that Trump will pick them to be vice president when he certainly runs again and becomes the nominee, or should he fall down or not be able to make the race, that, look, they could be the successor themselves. So that's what this is all about. We're just not used to seeing such outright immorality and indifference being expressed by people who swear oaths to protect, to preserve, and who are charged with life and death decisions of public responsibility.
You know, AB, if you want to go to the break in the strategy of a loss inspiring a political autopsy and then a course correction being made, it is 2015, 2016. The RNC did an autopsy. The loss after now Senator Romney loss was that the party didn't have broad enough appeal. And then in 15, they landed on Donald Trump. It seems that the model of going with politicians who repel independent voters. I mean, I want to just put up some of the poll numbers for the COVID policies announced by President Biden last week. 61% of independent voters support requiring federal employees to be vaccinated, 60% of all Americans. 62% of independents support requiring businesses with 100 or more employees. You know, gun safety legislation gets up to 85% of all Americans, upwards of that for independents. The right to choose in all or most instances is 64% issue in this country. What the Republicans have done is they've landed comfortably in the 28 to 40%, living with that. And it worked for Donald Trump one time, but it failed. You know, he never got above 44 from his entire presidency. He lost in a calamitous margin in the general election 2016. But as Steve said, that is the hole all the Republicans are following him down. Why?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the president denied the former president when he was president last March and April and May, even though he'd known about this virus for months, known how lethal it was, and knew to start work on a vaccine on January 30th, 2020, lied to the country and lied to his base, saying it was nothing and it was all going to be fine. And then started turning against the public health officials like Dr. Fauci and all of the advice he was getting to try to stop the infection from raging. And started talking about liberation and freedom. And his base has been on fire about this since last spring. So we're now a year and a half into this being sort of the requirement for, you know, the guiding North Star of MAGA now is to be against any kind of public health restrictions to help the greater good for the collective security of the country. No one is worried about jamming ICUs with COVID patients when other people who are vaccinated are having strokes or need cancer treatment. And this is something that is not popular with swing voters. That's what's so fascinating about Governors Abbott and DeSantis is that their numbers are going down. And so if you look at the polling that you cited, Nicole, on vaccines and mandates and masks, the numbers are so broad, Republicans support them. Republicans are vaccinated and they're getting fed up and they support a lot of these mandates. And so what you look at the Democrats next year, they're facing a lot of headwinds in trying to keep the House and the Senate. But one thing that's showing up in polling, and that's why you saw the Biden administration lean into these mandates in the last 6 weeks, is that swing voters are getting really fed up with Republicans' COVID radicalism. that they might be concerned about the spike in crime, the out of control border, and inflation, but they have had it with COVID radicalism. And so this is something that you see the Biden administration finally being really firm on. One aide used the term in that New York Times piece, militant. And that's because the voters feel unsafe and they want to return to normal.
I mean, that is such a good way to put it, COVID radicalism. And, you know, I know I talked to a senior White House official today, Sam, who said that the loose on COVID stance is really hurting Republicans. It shouldn't take a political reality to make Republicans want to save the lives and the lungs of the people whose lives and lungs they're responsible for. But I don't see any opportunity or window for anyone to make any adjustment. Where does this lead to? Where are we heading to?
Well, I think the White House's take from last night was that there was little political price and perhaps a lot of gain for Gavin Newsom in coming down aggressively in favor of things like vaccine mandates. And it gives them a bit of a upbeat posture going into the implementation of Biden's own vaccine mandates. The question is this applicable to states outside of California from a political standpoint? We're going to get another test run in Virginia, where you're already seeing those types of dividing lines. The Republican candidate for governor there supports vaccinations, has cut a PSA for it, but he is not in favor of mandating their use among workforces. Terry McAuliffe is. And so that's going to be a real test run to see how these things play out politically. But, you know, if you just look at the trajectory of this virus, with the number of hospitalizations, the fact that the Delta variant has disrupted the economic recovery, the fact that it is infecting children right as schools are trying to reopen, you do have to wonder if, you know, society-wide, people are just much more willing to take those types of aggressive steps, including vaccines, including mandates, and are willing to reward politicians who will stick their neck out for it. The White House certainly thinks that's the case. And, you know, I suspect that they look at California and say, yeah, we made the right call here.
Maybe the closing message, literally the what was on the front pages of today's newspapers in California, what was this message that Governor Newsom made very clear to my colleague Jacob Soboroff, that democracy is on the line? That has felt abstract, I think, for a while. But I wonder if having someone in a blue state like California say, if I, the Republican, lose, it will only be because it was rigged. It's nonsensical. I worked for California Republicans. I mean, you're almost a little more cautiously dubious if you win, if you're a Republican running statewide in California. It's so ludicrous. I wonder if that helped crystallize the delusions around these attacks on the vote itself.
I wondered about that because Larry Elder then decided to concede and not pursue a Donald Trump line about the rigging, even though Donald Trump was trying to do it for him several days ago, which amounts to flat out, straight up voter suppression of the Republican vote. You know, we've talked about this so many times, Nicole. The former president will break the Republican Party. They don't have to see it that way. We can all see it. It's Donald Trump's goal. He has no interest in the Republican Party. And so what he's going to do is try to say that every single election is rigged. If you are, you know, a candidate seeking his endorsement or trying to avert his wrath, you have to back the big lie. And when it comes time to vote, he's going to tell everyone not to turn out. So Republicans march down this road by their own volition, but they know exactly where it's going.
Yeah, I mean, Steve, look if it wasn't leading to the death and suffering of people from COVID disinformation, if it didn't imperil our democracy, if it didn't lead to the deadly insurrection, it would be so stupid that it would be funny. I mean, I don't even know so Trump as a participant in your election is what? He's a sugar high. He's a cyanide laced cocktail. I mean, what is he? And what is the calculation from serious people about how involved you want him to be in your general election?
Though it may be astonishing to somebody who woke up from a coma 25 years after going into it, you know, it has come to pass in America that Donald Trump of Queens was the president of the United States for 4 years, and he did catastrophic damage to America's democracy and to our global standing, weakened the American government, and created mass death where otherwise it would not have occurred with his pathological lying, culminating in this murderous insurrection where he refuses to yield power. And in that moment, and in that instant, and for everybody who followed him into the waters, they broke the deal. They broke the agreement about how we share power between us in this multiracial, multi-ethnic, continental nation of 350 million people. The idea that it's majority rule in a system where government is restrained, individual rights are protected, and the powers of government are enumerated, and we assign responsibilities under the law to individuals who win elections for a period of time. They broke that. They broke the deal. And so this age of radicalism that has descended on us, we are disoriented by. But all of the evidence suggests that fully one of our two political parties has opted out and has opted out in bad faith of the idea that you get power in this country through a competition that is decided in an election where the people are sovereign. And so democracy might be an archaic subject, but here's the deal about it. It's the only moral form of government that's ever been, because it's the only form of government that's ever existed that places the dignity and the power of the individual on top of the state and the powers of the state.
Sam, I think we captured hi to whoever's dog is barking. I know we're ready too.
Not but mine.
I don't want to frame him, but I have my suspicions about Steve. I think it's more accurate to describe the reaction among Democrats as relief, not ball spiking. Where does that come from?
Well, I think, yes, the sort of disaster scenario was that twofold. One was that Newsom actually was recalled, and for, I suppose, a brief period of time, it looked like it was within the realm of possibility. Although people on the ground in California that we were talking to throughout this really did feel like this was not going to happen. The second relief, I suppose, is that the margin was of such vastness that Elder could not conceivably make a claim that it was rigged. And in fact, as AB mentioned, which should not have been newsworthy, but in these times is newsworthy, he conceded.
Right.
I mean, that should have been natural, and that's what happens. But I guess in these moments, we do need to note that. So in that sense, there is some relief. But look, the people I talk to on the Democratic side of the aisle aren't gloating about this. I mean, they're gloating a little bit because they want to rub it in the face of Republicans. But if you talk to them sort of on a fundamental level about the state of our democracy, they're not happy about any of this. They think the idea that you could recall a governor with such a low threshold of signatures is fundamentally problematic. But there's not many avenues to reform that law in California will require the citizens to essentially give up that type of power through referendum. So they're not optimistic about that. Secondarily, they look at, you know, the fact that Elder and Trump both tried to hijack this and say this was rigged before results came in as fundamentally problematic for the rest of elections heading into 2022. So there are huge questions that Democrats and our society writ large are still grappling with today.
And we'll stay on all of them. Steve Schmidt, A.B. Stoddard, Sam Stein, thank you so much for starting us off on this news today. When we come back, President Biden expressing great confidence in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, along with others in Washington doing the same after those revelations that Milley had to warn his Chinese counterpart about an erratic and unstable lame duck president. Plus, in a Senate hearing today, powerful and emotional firsthand accounts of sexual abuse and institutional silence and inaction from four of the nation's top athletes. Their cries for accountability coming up. And later in the show, the Department of Justice's latest salvo to protect women's reproductive freedoms, challenging the Supreme Court to act. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
The nation's highest-ranking military officer, General Mark Milley's private turmoil, is detailed in the bombshell revelations in the new book, Peril. The authors report that he held a secret meeting with military commanders about the nuclear protocols and that he had phone calls with his Chinese counterpart, all to protect the country from an erratic and unstable and manic Donald Trump. In a statement released earlier today, a spokesperson for Milley did not deny that those conversations took place. Spokesperson responded to accusations by Trump allies like Marco Rubio that Milley tried to circumvent the ex-president. Statement says this, quote, "The chairman of the Joint Chiefs regularly communicates with chiefs of defense all across the world, including with China and Russia. These conversations remain vital to improving mutual understanding of U.S. national security interests, reducing tensions, providing clarity, and avoiding unintended consequences or conflict. General Milley continues to act and advise within his authority in the lawful tradition of civilian control of the military and his oath to the Constitution." President Biden today said he has, quote, "great confidence in General Milley." Press Secretary Jen Psaki went further in defending Milley. Take a listen.
"What I can assure you all of is that the president knows General Milley. He has been chairman of the Joint Chiefs for almost 8 months of his presidency. They've worked side by side through a range of international events. And the president has complete confidence in his leadership, his patriotism, and his fidelity to our Constitution. The outgoing president of the United States during this period of time fomented unrest, leading to an insurrection and an attack on our nation's capital on January 6th, which you all have covered extensively, of course, one of the darkest days in our nation's history. Beyond reports in this book, there's been widespread reporting and commentary from members of his own cabinet, the former president's cabinet, I should say, including high-ranking national security officials, questioning the former president's stability, his behavior, and his suitability to oversee the national security of the United States. So those are important questions that need to be discussed as well.
Joining our coverage, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senator, I'd like to ask you how we got here, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has to defend himself from anyone who aligned themselves with the ex-president's sort of foreign policy stench of debasing the military, talking about my generals, politicizing intelligence, repelling professionals from the national security establishment, and trying to extort a foreign leader. Why does Mark Milley need to be defended today?
Well, Nicole, first of all, I think we owe General Milley the chance to explain any of these comments. He's going to be appearing before the Senate over the next couple of weeks. But I join with, I think at this point, probably the vast majority of Americans that were quite worried after January 6th, to what extent would Donald Trump go to try to maintain his illegitimate claim of a stolen election or to retain power. I had a number of senior, even cabinet level officials in the Trump administration talking to me about whether they should resign or not. There was a great deal of concern. Some stayed because they were concerned that if they resigned, what might happen in those waning days. Again, I'm going to let General Milley explain his comments when he testifies. I'm not going to reference things that are in a book coming out. But those were challenging and dangerous days between the 6th and the 20th. And I think it begs beyond the challenge around Trumpism. And you laid out, you know, some of the litany of the remarkably bad events that took place. But I think it really is incumbent on going forward basis. And I say this vis-a-vis President Biden and future presidents. Congress needs to get its act together in terms of better oversight of the executive branch. My partner and great friend Tim Kaine has been trying for close to over 10 years now to make sure Congress steps back in and takes control of war-making powers, that we don't rely, whether on the case of the Afghanistan war or the Iraq war, on a congressional mandates that come back from 2001. I know going forward, my committee, the Intelligence Committee, has started a deep dive into what went right and what went wrong in terms of our exit from Afghanistan. I supported getting out of Afghanistan, but clearly there's got to be lessons learned. So beyond Trumpism, which obviously dominates a lot of conversation, but let's have Congress and both parties step up and do a better job of executive oversight.
My old boss, the ex-president, likened the current surge of or proliferation of domestic extremists to the terrorists who attacked this country on 9/11. Should Congress be doing more to protect this country in a bipartisan manner from the gravest current threat to the homeland, domestic extremists?
Well, I, first of all, commend President Bush for making those comments. And to do it on the anniversary of 9/11, I think it was appropriate. And I think he, frankly, was more eloquent than any current elected official has been about that comparison. I can also tell you from the intel side and the FBI side, the FBI ranks these domestic violent extremists, oftentimes white supremacists, in a category right next to those who are kind of foreign-based terrorists. And I think there is more that we can do. And I think what we've continued to see, I mean, remember, we are here in Washington, what, 3 days away from Saturday, where there is going to be a group of people supposedly coming in a week after the 20th anniversary of 9/11 to actually commemorate and celebrate the January 6th insurrection. And any elected official, I don't care which political party they belong to, if they are part or participate or in any way encourage that insurrectionist group coming in on Saturday the 18th, I really question their commitment to our country.
But for people that feel like Congress is broken, I mean, we couldn't have a bipartisan agreement on investigating a threat to Mike Pence and Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy's life. I mean, they were in danger that day, too. So what is the prospect for I mean, I guess it's progress that everyone says that out loud, that the FBI director testified that, yes, it's white supremacist aligned domestic terrorism that is the gravest threat. But you've got one of the two governing parties that won't even call it an insurrection. What can you say to reassure the public that Congress is working to protect us from their own supporters?
Listen, I'm disappointed there's not a bipartisan commission that looks into the origins of January 6th, beyond just the incident itself, but how, whether social media, misinformation, disinformation. My concern is that some of this, at least, is being propagated, formatted, and expanded by our enemies like Russia. But I don't think we should say that, you know, we can't ever get our act together. I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that my Senate Intelligence Committee, in a bipartisan way, spent 3 years looking into the Russia hack and disruption of our 2016 election. And we have laid out a series of recommendations to make sure it doesn't happen again. And candidly, we were better protected in 2020. I'm proud of the fact that the last couple of bipartisan pieces of legislation, from infrastructure to our concerns about China and its emergence as an economic power, those have all been passed bipartisan. They don't make as much news. And I actually take a little bit of solace out of the fact of Gavin Newsom's overwhelming victory. Yes, it was California, but the polls were very different a few weeks ago when he made the appeal to Californians of all political stripes. We don't want a return of Trumpism, or they didn't want a return of Trumpism. And it appears that that was with a resounding no, even at a margin greater than when he was elected. So does the Trump hold over some of my colleagues scare the heck out of me? Absolutely. But I think we just need to keep moving forward. I think my committee, for example, has got to continue to find out what went right and what went wrong in the case of Afghanistan, and how we learn and never go into one of these endless wars again. And I hope, as we saw in California, and I hope as we see selfishly in Virginia and a few weeks when we have our gubernatorial election, that will again be, in one way again, a mandate on Trumpism. I can tell you on a private basis, so many of these, my Republican friends, I think would be very happy to see Donald Trump fade away. But time will be one of the components of that happening.
I take your point about your committee's report on Donald Trump's ties to Russia. It was the only one, I believe, that included an addendum on compromise. It was detailed. It was incredible. I take your point, and I welcome you to come back and garner more attention for the bipartisan accomplishments of the Intelligence Committee. Senator Mark Warner, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Nicole. I just want to make sure there are some of us trying to still work together, but boy, oh boy, the period between the 6th and the 20th was one of the most, some of the most frightening times, I think, in our nation.
Well, let's keep the conversation going, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you. Four members of the U.S. gymnastics team today emotionally and bravely told their stories about abuse and a complicit system that failed them. What's next for them and other young people who are demanding that we all do better? Today, we witness gut-wrenching testimony by USA gymnasts at a Senate hearing describing the abuse they endured at the hands of the former team doctor, Larry Nassar, and the need for more accountability at every level.
To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse. In sacrificing my childhood for the chance to compete for the United States, I am haunted by the fact that even after I reported my abuse, so many women and girls had to suffer at the hands of Larry Nassar.
I told the FBI all of this, and they chose to falsify my report and to not only minimize my abuse, but silence me yet again. It was like serving innocent children up to a pedophile on a silver platter. Why did none of these organizations warn anyone? I am tired of waiting for people to do the right thing. Because my abuse was enough, and we deserve justice.
We have been failed, and we deserve answers. Enough is enough.
These brave women detailing their multiple instances of abuse and attempts to report them, including to the FBI, but how these organizations failed to do their job over and over again and failed to protect them, thwarting their attempts to bring Nassar to justice and to protect other girls. Just one single FBI agent has been fired so far. And just days before this hearing was scheduled to begin, FBI Director Christopher Wray spoke today about his agency's failure.
I want to be crystal clear. The actions and inaction of the FBI employees detailed in this report are totally unacceptable. These individuals betrayed the core duty that they have of protecting people. The FBI cannot carry out its vital mission of protecting the American people without trust. And in this case, FBI agents, certain FBI agents, broke that trust repeatedly and inexcusably.
Joining our coverage, Kavitha Davidson, sports and culture writer for the website The Athletic. She has been covering these women and the Nassar investigation and the failures surrounding it for years. Tell me how we got here.
Yeah, bear with me, Nicole, because it's a long road. The first victim reported on Larry Nassar when she was being treated by him at a local gymnastics club that was overseen by USA Gymnastics back in 1997. Michigan State, which is where he was the head athletic trainer, first was aware of some of these accusations in 99 and 2000. We're talking 20 years of failure here. A Title IX investigation finally came about at MSU in 2014, and it cleared him. What we didn't know at the time was that the FBI was then conducting interviews in 2015. And again, didn't write up reports on that for another 17 to 18 months. In 2016, finally, Larry Nassar is arrested, fired, and that was when the abuse finally stopped. And in 2017 is when we saw the members of the Fierce Five, these incredible gymnasts that we saw testify today, come forward with their own public stories, them being the most prominent faces of this abuse. In 2018, he was sentenced to more than 150 years in prison. And this past July, we got an Inspector General report detailing the failures of the FBI in those 18 months to do anything about these accusations.
I want to play some more of what they testified to today, specifically on their attempts to engage the FBI.
An important question remains, perhaps the most important question. Why? Why would the FBI agents lie to OIG investigators? Why would the FBI not properly document evidence that was received? Why would the FBI agent be interested in the USAG presidency? These questions remain unanswered.
And the survivors of Larry Nassar have a right to know why their well-being was placed in the jeopardy by these individuals who chose not to do their jobs. To date, no one from the FBI, the US OPC, or USAG has faced federal charges other than Larry Nassar.
Why haven't there been criminal referrals in this case?
It's a very good question. I think that that is what people are looking for. Jessica Howard, who was one of the victims, one of the gymnasts, said, you know, the only thing that we want right now is accountability and indictments, frankly. The FBI will say that the local, the field offices, it was their jurisdiction. It wasn't the national jurisdiction. There's some debate over that. There's also definitely some conflict of interest. In the Inspector General's report, they detail that one of these two investigators who wasn't fired, he resigned. He was actually looking for a job at the USOC in 2015 when these interviews were being conducted. There are a lot of questions here about institutional failure, and it's not just the FBI. It's from the ground up. It's USA Gymnastics. It's Michigan State. It's the USOC. It's Safe Sport, the Committee to Safe Sport, and it's the FBI.
When the FBI misses a terror threat, everything changes. We change everything. The FBI was overhauled. When the FBI spends 20 years ignoring sexual abuse, what should happen?
It's a really good question. I always think back, actually, to the fact that Jerry Sandusky's conviction for abusing boys at Penn State was in 2012. It's been a decade that we have had to overhaul how we protect young athletes, how we protect children, and we haven't. And these systems have just failed them time and time again. And frankly, it shouldn't take the most prominent faces, the most famous women and athletes to bring these issues to light. But that's also exactly why these women have continued to compete. Simone Biles said before Tokyo that the reason she came back was in order to continue to be able to hold these institutions accountable. I think we need to see an overhaul. One of the things that Ali Raisman said was the Center for Safe Sport needs to be independently funded and not funded by the USOC, by the governing body that they're tasked to investigate. And there needs to be more than two people who are in charge of these investigations, because too much has broken down in the past for that to be the case.
And I guess just finally, I mean, if the most prominent female athletes in our country, some of the most prominent athletes in the world, aren't believed when they allege sexual abuse, what's happening to everyone else who alleges abuse?
It's such an important point, and we have to remember that this isn't limited to sports. Within sports, it's not limited to USA Gymnastics, USA Swimming, wrestling, hockey, junior hockey, with a bunch of boys who have been abused are going through this as well. And it should not take hundreds, it should not take a handful of victims who are famous to obscure the hundreds of victims who aren't, who don't have this platform. And we have to take this seriously, not just when it's such an egregious case involving hundreds of children, not when there's an alleged cover-up involved, and not just, frankly, when it's politically expedient on both parties, when it's a bipartisan thing in order to hold these people accountable.
And Christopher Wray is welcome to join us. I'll have you along, Kavitha, anytime to answer these questions. Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. Kavitha Davidson, thank you for your coverage on this and for spending some time with us. Up next for us, another grim milestone in the coronavirus pandemic, as those peddling disinformation show no signs of losing enthusiasm for their lies.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Another grim and tragic pandemic milestone has been reached today. In this country, we've now lost 1 in 500 Americans to COVID-19. Still, people like Tucker Carlson can't let any chance at disseminating disinformation slip away from him, doubling down last night on Nicki Minaj's tweet from 2 days ago, an unproven claim about a vaccine side effect that isn't, an account from her cousin's friend criticized by scientists and doctors as false information. Watch.
We haven't been able to figure out whether this show is broadcast in Trinidad, But if Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend is watching, or his former fiance is watching, we want to hear your story. We're coming to Port of Spain to see you.
Let's go to Trinidad to hear the story. Let's bring in our coverage Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital and the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. You've been warning about vaccine disinformation. I know you have literally written the book about it. I don't want to ask you your surprise, but are you discouraged by how much heat and energy is behind the right-wing disinformation campaign being waged all day, every day?
You know, Nicole, I think by next week, we're going to reach 675,000 Americans who've lost their life from COVID-19. That number is significant because that's the CDC's estimate of the number of people who died in the 1918 to 1921 flu pandemic. So we're about to exceed that, and we're going to reach around 800,000 deaths by the end of the year. And so many of those deaths were not only from the SARS-2 coronavirus, it was defiance against vaccines, especially in the last few months. This is death by anti-science. And a lot of this has been coming out of the nighttime Fox News anchors, this disinformation. And, you know, I'm often asked about Tucker Carlson or, you know, the others, Laura Ingraham, I don't know. And what I say is, look, I don't think this has anything to do with the individual Fox anchors. This is coming from the top. This is a war of aggression against science and scientists coming out of Fox News as part of a larger authoritarian effort to discredit science and scientists. And I don't really know what the motivation is, but it's having just a devastating effect. Just since May alone, Nicole, 100,000 Americans who have lost their lives, almost all of them unvaccinated, despite the availability of safe and effective vaccines. These are 100,000 lives that never had to be lost. And it goes beyond heartbreaking.
The Pope today weighed in saying this. Humanity has a history of friendship with vaccines. Does that help? I mean, can we still be helped by reassurances on the other side of the equation?
No, absolutely. And we need the clergy to step up in a big way. And so, yes, absolutely. The Pope has a lot of influence, and the Vatican has been pretty strong on vaccines and vaccinations in recent history. So that certainly helps. But, you know, we've got now so much of this anti-vaccine, anti-science sentiment coming out of the far right. And tragically, people are defining their allegiance or defining their belonging to a group by defying vaccines. And now you're starting to see this move up into Canada as well. So we've been exporting this kind of anti-science aggression from the far right. And we've also seen similar health freedom, phony language like that used now in the UK and in Europe. Yeah. So we export our culture, and we're exporting this.
It is so sad. Thank you for remaining on the front lines, undaunted. Dr. Peter Hotez, thank you so much for being part of our coverage today. The next Star of Deadline White House starts after a very short break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
These laws were not passed because the state of Texas rose up and wanted abortion to become illegal. It happened because of a Republican legislature and a Republican governor who wanted to impose their own politics on the women and the families of Texas. That is where I think, this is where I believe they have gone so far. It's not a question of whether Roe will be overturned. Roe was just overturned in the state of Texas.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. The magnitude of Texas's new law banning abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, laid out plainly and sharply by former president of Planned Parenthood, Cecile Richards. That clip was from Richards on this program a week ago. Since then, we've seen the federal government take action against Texas's ban, underscoring the high stakes of this legislation for the future of women's reproductive freedoms, not just in Texas, but all across the country. On Thursday, the U.S. DOJ sued the state over its new law. And last night, the department went even further. From the New York Times reporting, quote, the Justice Department asked a federal judge late Tuesday to issue an order that would prevent Texas from enforcing a law that prohibits nearly all abortions, ratcheting up a fight between the Biden administration and the state's Republican leaders. The Justice Department argued in its emergency motion that the state adopted the law known as Senate Bill 8, quote, to prevent women from exercising their constitutional rights, reiterating an argument the department made last week when it sued Texas to prohibit enforcement of the contentious new law. The DOJ also addressed a sinister part of the law, the part that allows Texas citizens to become vigilantes and take legal action against anyone performing or, quote unquote, aiding and abetting an abortion. From the court filing, quote, Texas devised an unprecedented scheme that seeks to deny women and providers the ability to challenge SB 8 in federal court. This attempt to shield a plainly unconstitutional law from review cannot stand. 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court refused to block Texas's law, saying challenges to it did not address complex and novel procedural questions. But the lawsuit filed by the DOJ could compel the high court to address what it has not previously. The Times explains that, quote, the Supreme Court did not rule on whether SB 8 was constitutional when it refused to block the law. The Justice Department has placed its constitutionality at the heart of the lawsuit, which could force the court to consider new factors and possibly come to a different decision if it hears the case. A related case the court will hear is one over an abortion law in Mississippi. And the recent ruling on the Texas law provides new context around the Mississippi case. From the Washington Post reporting, quote, the 5-4 decision indicated the increasingly conservative court is more open to altering decades of Supreme Court precedent. More from the Post, quote, abortion providers told the Supreme Court on Monday that approving a Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks would scuttle a half century of precedent and invite states to ban abortion entirely. Women's reproductive freedoms now hang in the balance. It's where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters in France. Katie Benner's here, Justice Department reporter for The New York Times. Also joining us, Katie Kay, Washington editor for Aussie Media. And Neil Katyal's back, former acting solicitor general, now a Georgetown law professor. Lucky for us, all three MSNBC contributors. Katie, this is your reporting. Take me inside what DOJ is trying to do here.
Sure. So the Justice Department is trying to get enforcement of the law stopped. When the Supreme Court said in the beginning of September that it was not going to step in, you saw providers in Texas scramble to comply with the law. You saw abortions halted, you saw appointments canceled, and you saw women all over the state try to figure out what to do next. Basically, what the Justice Department's arguing is that unconstitutionally stopped these women from taking part in a procedure that is constitutionally protected. They're saying that basically the law's enforcement must be stopped while the courts sort out what to do about the law, which is something that has happened in several other cases where we've seen novel things come up, where we've seen things be very controversial, that the courts basically put a freeze on enforcement while courts and lawyers work through the legal system to determine the ultimate and final outcome.
Kenny Kay, do you have any doubt that it's the substance of the law that resulted in the court seemingly confounded by the mechanism not being enforcement by the state, but vigilante enforcement by neighbors and citizens?
If it was, then why aren't they looking at other issues, you know, that they could have ruled on as well? I mean, I think it's interesting that what the Justice Department said last night again was that using the word constitutionality and the Supreme Court trying to say, no, this is not about constitutionality. Texas saying this is not about constitutionality. But effectively what's happening here is that you're making abortion so difficult to get that practically it has been banned in Texas. And I can't see that any other issue would have galvanized the Supreme Court, this conservative Supreme Court with now Amy Coney Barrett on it, to rule in this particular way, to allow effectively, as the Biden administration said, vigilantism to be the law of the land in Texas. I mean, it's hard to think, I mean, Neil would know better than me, but I can't think of any other area of American life where the Supreme Court would encourage vigilantism as a form of justice effectively.
Yeah, I mean, so I want to get to what the DOJ lawsuit is and does and what's happening to women in Texas. But I'm really trying to understand this, Neil, and you've been entertaining my questions now for as long as we've been covering this, and I'm grateful for that. But if a blue state passed an assault weapons ban and the enforcement mechanism was a neighbor could sue them and said, we didn't violate, what is it, Heller, that prevents that from happening, would the court take the same position, or is it the substance of abortion that is shaping letting this law stand?
You're nothing if not consistent, Nicole. You asked me that question 2 weeks ago today, right when the Supreme Court ruled. And the answer then was, no, these vigilante laws are preposterous. And nobody thinks that this is the right way to run a constitutional system. The fact that it's done by private entities means somehow you get a get out of jail free card. That's ridiculous. If anything, it's worse than having the state do it. And yes, if it were guns or anything else, I expect those laws to be struck down in a matter of minutes. And so we are in this very unusual posture. And this is where the Justice Department filing last night is so important, because I think it confirms what many of us already knew, which is the stakes of abortion access are far too high for this constitutional right to be taken away without so much as even a written judicial opinion by the Supreme Court, just because it's left to private vigilantes and the like. And so we talked about this 1 week ago on your show. You know, the Justice Department filed a lawsuit the last week, but it didn't have any immediate effect. They needed to come in and file that new piece of paper, which they did last night, which says, stop this law now. It's creating a chilling effect. It's taking away women's rights. And then let's have the court case and the argument about it. But in the interim, let's make sure that women's rights are protected.
And what are the prospects of that being successful now?
I think they're very high in the trial court and the Court of Appeals, even though the Court of Appeals is a very conservative one, the Fifth Circuit. I mean, there is nobody who thinks that the Texas law complies with Roe versus Wade, not even the people who wrote the Texas law. That's why they went through this harebrained scheme of vigilantes, because they were afraid of courts reviewing what they were doing. And now the Justice Department's called them on it and said, okay, you know, maybe individuals can't sue, but certainly we, the Justice Department, can, and that's what they've done. And so I think it's a very successful lawsuit through at least the Court of Appeals. And then the question is the Supreme Court going to overrule Roe versus Wade?
And are they?
Well, I think, you know, we'll let that court case proceed. Certainly there are many justices on there who would like to overrule it. On the other hand, you do have Chief Justice Roberts, who is an institutionalist, who's already, you can tell, very bothered by this Texas law. I mean, he called it a scheme, which is not so, this is not like Justice Scalia, someone who uses words like that, you know, in opinion after opinion. That was a very interesting opinion for us court watchers. And the question is, does the Chief Justice control the Supreme Court right now? Is it the Roberts Court or is it, you know, the Thomas Court?
I think that's a question that keeps a lot of, not just women, but a lot of people up at night. Katie Benner, I want to come back to the Garland DOJ. We have an unprecedented assault on the right to vote in America, predicated on something that Republicans in the states passing voter restrictions will admit publicly is a lie. The idea that there was fraud in 2020, there wasn't. We have this real and immediate threat to overturning Roe v. Wade. Take me inside the Garland Justice Department.
Yeah, I think that the Justice Department understands that not only does it want to uphold the policies and the postures of the Biden administration, people inside of the Justice Department do truly believe that they're upholding the Constitution and pushing back on voter restrictions they see as undue, and in pushing back on what you've called an assault on Roe versus Wade and an assault on abortion rights in the country. When you read the briefs, you can see that they were constructed by lawyers who try very, very hard to make this not a partisan issue, but an issue of whether or not we want to uphold the Constitution. Even when Merrick Garland announced the lawsuit last week, he announced it by saying, this is not about politics. We should be chilled, is what he said. We should be extremely concerned by any state law that would use a mechanism like this, basically taking enforcement out of the hands of a state government and putting it into the hands of private individuals. That this is something that if we love the Constitution, and if we love the rule of law, is something that should really concern us. So I do think the department, while it is clear that these are Biden administration policies, the department also wants to make clear that it is making these moves. It is pushing back on restrictive voter laws. It is pushing back on the Texas law because it believes that these are things that infringe upon the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, Katie, I think that's part of the story that maybe didn't sink in right away, that this law was written as a go around. I mean, there was some great reporting in Katie's paper. I mean, this was a guy working on a workaround to pass judicial scrutiny for many, many years. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. And I think the integrity of the court's on the line, not just around abortion, but do they want to look like they can be duped?
Yeah, and the question is, you know, if you can do this on abortion and if Texas gets away with this, and you can employ vigilantes and citizens basically to enact the law on abortion, what else could you use it for? Could you use it on gun control? Could you use it on other issues of civil rights? I mean, presumably the sky's the limit at that point, which you could try and say, we're going to take the rule of law in the United States of America out of the hands of the courts and put it into the hands of the people. And the way that you're going to get around this, people like, you know, Cecile Richards, who I've spoken to about this, say, is it has to become a politically motivating issue. I mean, at the moment, just on the issue of abortion, Democrats still aren't there yet. In the 2020 election, it ranked bottom of the list of concerns of Biden voters. It's something like 3 or 4 for the list of concerns of Trump voters. So the Democrats are going to have to work hard to mobilize their base. They're trying to. They're looking at, you know, 2022 Senate races in Nevada, where they're saying, we're going to take the issue of abortion, we're going to elevate it, we're going to take it to the people, we're going to take the Texas law to the people and try and issue elevate the issue of abortion and make it. But it never has been up until now. It's such a motivating issue for Republican voters. If Democrats want to stop this happening in Texas and in other states and potentially beyond, they're going to have to make this more of a voting issue, which is something that, you know, Cecile Richards is well aware of.
I mean, now I hate to put everything on the one party that's not trying to destroy our democracy and deprive women of reproductive freedoms, but Katty has a point. I mean, this joins all these other things, sacred things they're trying to protect, voting rights and the COVID package and other priorities. I wonder where you think this should rank.
Well, I think it ranks higher than anything else, because I think, you know, at least in terms of the electorate. So, you know, Roe versus Wade is one of the very few decisions that most Americans know by name. I mean, that list is like Brown versus Board of Education and Dred Scott. That's probably it. And the idea that if the Supreme Court next year before the Senate election decides to overrule Roe and return us to, you know, pre-1973, you know, that is something every American will feel and understand in a way that technical things, even about things as important as voting or whatever, don't have the same kind of salience in the public eye. So that's one thing. The other kind of thing I'd watch is, I think Katie made a really good, Katie Vedder made a really good point about Garland and the way he announced this lawsuit is non-political. Just remember that Merrick Garland, yes, he was nominated to the Supreme Court and didn't get through, but this is a man who has the incredible respect of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court. I mean, he served as our nation's chief judge of its second highest court for 20 years, never once overruled by the Supreme Court in his 20 years there. So the fact that he's leading this litigation makes it different than all the prior abortion litigation, even what went up to the court 2 weeks ago. And I think if there is a chance for the court to do the right thing, having Garland at the helm is the way to do it. He'll do it responsibly, carefully, and within the bounds of the law.
You know, Neil, the business community has responded interestingly. Salesforce has offered to, I think, move people out of the state of Texas. I had the general counsel for Lyft on, which has offered to defend any of their drivers who are sued under the vigilante law. I was thinking of what Ted Olson and David Boyce did around marriage equality, and I wonder if you see any folks like yourself, any sort of giants in the legal world, coming together to make sure we don't go back to a pre-Roe versus Wade reality for women in America.
I mean, sign me up, and I think lots of other people up, because this is chilling, scary, and not America. And so I hope to see that kind of coalition develop. And it should develop on, as you say, not on political lines. I mean, this is a fundamental choice about women's equality. People should make it for themselves that, you know, they can have all sorts of personal opinions on it. But the idea that a state, and particularly through a sneak attack with a vigilante provision like this, is allowed to do this, that's not the American system of justice.
Katie, I want to ask you a question about sort of covering the Trump Justice Department, which was under assault by the president. And then by the end, I mean, you did some of the most extraordinary reporting on how he sought to co-opt the Justice Department in his assault on the democracy. You're now covering the Biden Justice Department, trying to protect the whole country from state Republicans' assault on the rule of law around this issue and around voting. And I wonder what that pivot is like for you.
Well, I mean, in some ways, it feels like we are going back to a far more normal debate between the federal government and states' rights along party lines that we've seen before. I think that the Trump administration, it's safe to say, was extraordinarily unusual, and that It's very difficult to compare it to anything
else. It is safe to say that.
So I will probably leave it at that. And I'll also note that what we're seeing is the federal government being finally forced to weigh in on a fight that has been waged in the country for two decades as states have chipped away at the right to an abortion, or as, you know, advocates call reproductive rights. So even though we're talking about this today as an essential fight and as a fight that is going to determine the course of women's reproductive health, which it certainly is, it is the continuation of a 20-year battle. Nowhere is that seen more than in the Mississippi case that is before the Supreme Court right now, keeping in mind that the abortion clinic in that case is one of the last, if not the last, mm-hmm. abortion clinic in the entire state. And there are a lot of places in the country like that. So we are not necessarily fighting a battle in which the sides are even or in which things could go either way. There's a battle being waged between the federal government and the state of Texas that is a continuation, and that we've seen states' rights very slowly creep and gain more power, and we've mm-hmm. seen reproductive rights being reduced.
Katie Benner and Katie Kay, thank you both so much for starting us off this hour. Neil is sticking around. When we come back, an outrageous step by Republicans in Pennsylvania looking for fraud that doesn't exist there or anywhere. They now want the personal records of every Pennsylvania voter, including driver's license numbers and partial Social Security numbers, as part of their big lie-inspired review of the 2020 election. That story's next. Plus, a new compromise plan to protect voting rights unveiled by Senate Democrats has already been rejected by Senate Republicans, the same ones who are waging war on democracy from coast to coast. We'll ask the top senator where the fight for voting rights goes from here, and the threat of domestic terror at the U.S. Capitol. There's new information on what law enforcement officials are bracing for, with just days to go before a rally in support of the January 6th insurrectionists. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Today, Republicans proving once again just how far they're willing to go to please the disgraced ex-president and his embarrassing big lie quest. It's a new invasive low for them. A Pennsylvania Senate subcommittee, as part of their taxpayer-funded baseless investigation into the 2020 presidential election, voted along party lines today to seek personal information on every voter in Pennsylvania. New York Times' Nick Corsiniti writes this, quote, rubber stamping more than a dozen subpoenas for driver's license numbers and partial Social Security numbers. The subpoenas, 17 of them in all, also included a request for communications between state and county election officials. Joining our conversation is New York Times domestic correspondent Nick Corsiniti, and Neil Katyal still here. Nick, I have interviewed Attorney General Josh Shapiro multiple occasions, who has assured me that this wouldn't happen and it wouldn't go anywhere. Despite those assurances, these moves are still going to fuel the fanaticism of fraud. And I wonder if you could just take us inside what they're doing.
Well, this is the first step in an investigation that's been convened in late August by Jay Corman, the top Republican in the Senate in Pennsylvania. And, you know, once he convened that committee to look into the investigation, to look into the election, they were given subpoena power. And so this was kind of the first step. And it's a pretty substantial first step, requesting the personal identifiable information of nearly 7 million voters in Pennsylvania without their consent, by the way, is a pretty grand request. And Democrats and Attorney General Shapiro, who I spoke to for the article, both said that they're instantly going to try and block this in courts, that they think it's an overreach, and that they think, you know, it's even goes beyond separation of powers, and that only the executive branch in Pennsylvania has the authority to get this much information and review it. And then it also might even just be a violation of federal privacy law. But all that said, it kind of speaks to how the Pennsylvania legislature has slowly come to grips with launching a full investigation of the 2020 election, now some 10 or getting close to 11 months since it happened in November. You know, they were initially somewhat resistant. Senator Cormann said he didn't want to relitigate the election. But then, you know, after public pressure from former President Trump, probably from some of the base in Pennsylvania, he said that we do need a forensic audit, which is, again, not something that happens. None of these reviews are forensic audits. They're partisan election reviews. And then, you know, now we kind of see them form the committee, take the steps to start this investigation. And it's kind of it's one more, you know, Arizona-like partisan investigation that, while it creates security problems and real concerns for privacy in terms of Pennsylvania, it also just further undermines confidence in the elections.
Were any of these Republicans on the ballots that they now want to investigate?
I believe that most of them were, which is the case that we've seen in so many different states. You know, they don't have an issue with the election that led to them getting elected and seated, and they didn't object to their own seating, but they did object to the presidential election.
Will they give up their, are they going to agree to give up their seats if any? I mean, they're going to fabricate fraud on one line, but not on the other. So it's not about ballots. It's about, I mean, do people know what a ballot looks like? It's one form. Are they looking, what are they looking for?
That's a great question. What Senator Dush, who's leading the investigation, said is he repeated some allegations that, again, have been disproven. And Senate Democrats were quick to tell him that they had been disproven, that some voters who would cast mail ballots just simply didn't exist. And again, this is not true. This is disinformation that has been spread on social media and in some right-wing news sites, more lies about the 2020 election. And they've also, you know, they don't even have a vendor for this yet. So they don't even know what's going to happen if they were to get this information, who's going to review it. And when Senator Dush was pressed by Democrats to, you know, who is going to look at this, who are you looking at? What vendors could possibly undertake this in a fair manner? You know, he was kind of standoffish. He didn't answer any specific questions. And when he was even pressed, like, will they have ties to known conspiracy theorists? One senator brought up Sidney Powell, the lawyer who has pushed some pretty outlandish conspiracies about the 2020 election. And he said, you know, that's not of my concern. And so they followed up and said, well, is that possible? And he said, yeah, it's absolutely possible. So I don't think they're considering their own election, their own ballot, or really anything other than pressure from both their base and then also former President Trump to just continue litigating the 2020 election.
Neil Katyal, again, it would be stupid and maybe funny if it wasn't dangerous and deadly. And I wonder if there are federal laws that are in question of turning over all that private data in a voter file. Not a voter file, absolutely. But on ballots, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with a request this big, the Pennsylvania Republicans aren't just going on a fishing expedition. They're bringing like an entire commercial trawler. And they're asking for all of the information, you know, a bunch of private information about 7 million voters in Pennsylvania. There's a reason why states don't do anything like that. And look, maybe if there was some like extraordinary public reason for this, that'll be one thing. But remember, this is something in which these allegations about what happened in the 2020 election have been litigated in court after court after court in Pennsylvania. They've been debunked a bazillion times. And so they got their day in court, they got another, and they're still not satisfied. It's like the longest scam ever. Like, I'm old enough to remember when a scam was just like an email from a Nigerian prince or something, not some months-long legislative investigation that allows the state to get the access of 7 million information to 7 million voters. So, you know, I think that this is, you know, deeply problematic from a privacy perspective, from a federal law perspective, but also, you know, I thought the Republicans were the party of small government, and here they are trying to reach in and get the private information of 7 million voters. I mean, you know, maybe they're the party of Putin. I don't know, but it's not America.
It sure is not. Nick, thank you for staying on this. Neil, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. When we return, how far are Senate Democrats willing to go to protect democracy? Now that Republicans have batted away a compromise offer on voting rights. Senator Angus King is our next guest. Don't go anywhere.
I am excited and very supportive of the Freedom to Vote Act. It takes the best intentions that we have for protecting our democracy and concretizes it, making sure that we have uniform standards across this country so that the quality of our democracy doesn't vary from geography to geography or based on your race.
Stacey Abrams' endorsement of the newly revealed Freedom to Vote Act, a bill that now has the unique distinction of full Democratic support in the U.S. Senate, carries immense weight. Here's what's in the bill. It remedies restrictions by enabling all voters to request mail-in ballots and putting in place minimum standards to ensure that drop boxes are available to all voters. The measure also requires states to offer at least 15 days of early in-person voting, to register eligible voters automatically with their driver's license, and to offer Election Day registration. In addition, the bill sets reliable evidentiary standards to constrain the massive voter registration purges that are taking place in states such as Georgia. Crucially, for in-person voting, the bill makes Election Day a holiday. It also targets Georgia's inhumane new legislation that prohibits individuals from providing water or food to voters waiting in long lines. Joining us now, Senator Angus King of Maine. He's a member of the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. It's great to see you, Senator. Tell me where this stands.
Well, it stands that the bill was introduced yesterday and the ink was hardly dry before apparently the Republicans in a uniform way said no, which really disappoints me because a lot of effort went into really paring down the bill that passed the House last year and getting to a place that I think is a common sense set of minimum standards to apply across the country. And the fact that the Republicans apparently have just rejected it out of hand, I suspect not many of them have read it. And I find that very disappointing. So what happens now? We have to really face a moment of truth, and that is, what do we do about the filibuster? I've always been one that's been very reluctant about changing the filibuster because, you know, what is now an annoying nuisance to the majority can turn into a shield later on when the shoe's on the other foot. On the other hand, we're talking about democracy itself here, and we're talking about the right to vote. And what really bothers me, I have to tell you, I feel like the world's turned upside down. When I was governor, I used to have a standing bet with my colleague Jesse Ventura in Minnesota about which state would have the highest turnout. I thought that was the whole idea, more people voting. That's what democracy should be all about. And we were always trying to see, you know, who could have the highest turnout. And here we are now, and we've got a political party that seems to be betting its future on keeping people from voting. So I think there's going to be a lot of very deep conversation about where we go from here. I don't think the filibuster will be necessarily abolished, but I think it may be modified in some way. And here's the numerical reality, Nicole. I did the math the other day. You can assemble 41 Republican senators, which is enough to block anything, representing 24% of the American people. That means 24% of the American people's representatives can block what 76% of the American people's representatives want. And I don't think the framers contemplated that. They knew fractions. They put them in the Constitution in various places, but they didn't put a fraction in the Constitution for the passage of major legislation. So there's going to be some heavy debate over the next several weeks. I hope some of the Republicans will come around and say, wait a minute, this bill's not so bad. We ought to talk about possibly coming to some resolution here.
There's nothing bad in the bill, but Republicans won't come around. I mean, they've shown you who they are. Isn't it time to believe them?
Well, yeah. You know me, Nicole. I'm a perennial optimist, and maybe there'll be some public pressure. My sense is that the public understands this issue and supports what we're trying to do here, which, again, are common sense sort of minimum standards nationwide. This isn't a federal takeover of elections. It's setting some minimum standards, and then the states will run the elections as they always have. And by the way, the Constitution expressly contemplates Congress stepping in this kind of situation with regard to voting rights in the states. And the other thing that's frustrating is the Voting Rights Act was last renewed in 2006. You know what the vote was? 98-0.
I mean,
why has this become a partisan issue? I don't really get it.
Yes, you do. And let me just, may I just speak as a former political operative. You have 65% of the public. You don't need to do any public relations around this bill. What you need to do is get your caucus on board with suspending the filibuster. And I wonder if you could share with us who you think the holdouts will be.
Well, I'm not going to do that. You're free to ask that question. I'm not going to answer it. But I mean, I think it's well known that Joe Manchin from the state of Senator Byrd is very reluctant about it. Christian Sinema has mentioned it. There are others. And as I say, I was always one that said, you know, we got to be careful here because this could come back and bite us in 2, 4, 6, 8 years. But I think, again, democracy is a separate issue. And that's really what we're talking about. And everybody's on board in the caucus with this bill, including two independents, myself and Bernie. And so the question is, what will we do next? Jeff Merkley from Oregon has really done a enormous amount of work on this, trying to find ways to modify the filibuster in such a way, for example, to make people talk. I mean, the public has an impression that the filibuster, you go and you got to hold the floor for hours and hours and hours. You know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. That's not true anymore. It's too damn easy. You can phone in a filibuster. I'm opposed. I'll filibuster. Okay, it requires 60 votes. So I think one of the options is to make it harder and make the people who want to block things hold the floor and make their argument to the American people. There are a lot of other possibilities. For example, instead of requiring 60 votes to go ahead, you require 40 votes to stop. That means they have to show up. So as I say, there are going to be lots of discussions. I believe, Nicole, that you're going to see some changes in the filibuster as a result, not of what the Democrats and the Democratic caucus want to do, but because the Republicans won't just even discuss the issue.
Have other people had the evolution you've had, people who were previously reluctant to touch it but now think it's a good idea?
I think they have. I think a lot of people, and again, I distinguish between various pieces of legislation on this or that subject, immigration or whatever, and democracy itself. And, you know, it's ironic that you're talking about minority control on democracy, which has the effect of disenfranchising minorities around the country. I think there are other people that have had that evolution. And like I say, I don't think I'm prepared to abolish it altogether, but I am prepared to make some changes that I think will be necessary and that will enable us to finally move forward on this.
When you're ready to share any names with us, please come back. I have to ask you, you had a breakthrough COVID case. How are you feeling? And did it change any of your views on mandates or indoor mask wearing, regardless of vaccine status?
Well, I did. And I was pretty sick for 2 or 3 days. The symptoms started to dissipate. I had to isolate for 10 days. My wife would bring the food to put it by the door, knock on the door, and then run. But I'm fine now. But here's the reality, Nicole. I think the vaccine saved my life.
Yeah.
If I hadn't been vaccinated, given the severity of the symptoms that I had, which is like the worst head cold you ever had, mm-hmm. times two, if I hadn't been vaccinated, there's no question I would have been in the hospital. 99% of the people in the hospital today are unvaccinated. And over 90% of those who had a breakthrough case like I did aren't in the hospital. So it really confirmed my belief in the vaccine. And this is a case where, you know, people talk about personal freedom. Well, you don't have the freedom to infect somebody else. And you know, if you don't care about your own health, that's one thing. But people are something like 5 times more likely to spread the disease if they're unvaccinated. And I just think that's unacceptable. So I have the personal experience of absolutely believing that the vaccine is a lifesaver, and this pandemic would be largely over. What we're having now is a distinct, separate pandemic from the one we had last year. This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. The pandemic for the vaccinated is over, except for these breakthrough cases, which end up with symptoms that are clearly survivable. But that's what's really troubling about this. And I think we need to move on. I mean, all of us had vaccinations as kids. Come on. George Washington had the army in the Revolution vaccinated for smallpox. And I lived through polio. I lived through the polio scourge in the 50s. Polio was eliminated by the vaccine. I think a lot of these folks have forgotten that. Vaccines are a miracle of modern medicine. and they save millions of lives around the world. And let's get over it and move on and save lives here. Every death that we have that's unvaccinated is a preventable death, and that's a tragedy.
I think it's really important that people hear from you, that you think you survived your bout with the breakthrough COVID infection because of the vaccine. I hope they call on you to shout that from the rooftops. And we're really glad that you're okay and your family's okay. Senator Angus King, thank you so much for spending some time with us. When we return, new details about the law enforcement officers who were disciplined after the January 6th insurrection, as officials brace for another rally at the Capitol and another incident with the potential for violence this weekend.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
We're following some brand new updates today regarding those six Capitol Police officers facing discipline for their actions during the deadly insurrection on January 6th. According to documents obtained by McClatchy, at least three of the cases involve Capitol Police officers who allegedly posed for photos with the rioters. One of the officers told investigators that he took the photo with the suspect only to identify him later. Perhaps more shocking is the allegation leveled against one officer in the Protective Services Bureau who faces discipline for possibly revealing a secure location that lawmakers that day were in. From the reporting, quote, the allegation stems from a conversation the officer had with a friend the week after the riot in which he allegedly revealed information about the secure location he helped evacuate lawmakers to during the riot. The agent denied that he was sympathetic to the cause of the rioters, but he acknowledged that he may have inadvertently shared information about the secure location. Quote, I can't say 100% that I didn't do what you're telling me I did, the agent told investigators. The news coming as we're just a few days away from a pro-insurrectionist rally scheduled at the U.S. Capitol on Saturday. It's expected to draw roughly 700 people, according to DHS. With the memory of January 6th still fresh in the minds of the country, questions remain about just how prepared the nation's capital will be, as well as capitals across the country. Joining our coverage, Miles Taylor, former Department of Homeland Security Chief of Staff, and Jackie Alemany, Washington Post congressional correspondent, author of The Post, the early 202 newsletter. Miles, so he allegedly revealed where lawmakers were hiding and didn't get fired. What could we be missing about that?
Well, look, Nicole, I would say that, first of all, that's very concerning. It's very serious. And that's something that Capitol Police are going to have to take into consideration when in the future they're deciding how to safeguard members and the protocols and procedures around making sure that there's operational security around that information. So that's really, really important. But I would emphasize here that one of the things that this review showed is that this was not an inside job. And I know that sounds crazy to even have to say it, but there were conspiracy theories in the aftermath of January 6th that somehow our brave law enforcement officers who protected the Capitol were secretly a part of it and facilitating it. By and large, most of these allegations, most of the officers who faced allegations were cleared of those. And I actually think that's the good news here. And it's good to see that Capitol Police are taking remedial action against individuals who had infractions. But at the same time, I've got a bigger concern here, and that is that there are some members of Congress who are actively sympathizing more with the rioters from that day who committed offenses than they are with the police officers who defended the Capitol. So that's a worry and in fact, an irony here.
Jackie, that of it is enough, right? That there is a rally in support of jailed insurrectionists is an words I can't say on TV moment for the entire country. There are people coming to Washington to celebrate and support jailed insurrectionists who tried to thwart the transfer of power at the behest of Donald Trump.
I'm told by folks that look at the threats that they're more concerned about what happens outside of Washington, that all the publicity around this J6 event has probably kept the Proud Boys away. In fact, the Proud Boys are telling their members not to come.
Yeah, Nicole, and it's not just, you know, these protesters being encouraged by an outside group that's been planning this rally, but there's also elected officials who have been actively encouraging these insurrectionists and coming to their defense, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz's, and Paul Gosar's of the world, who have been consistently giving these people a platform. But look, I think this time around, I just got off the phone with a Capitol Hill police officer who said that for the most part, they are feeling pretty good going into this weekend about where they are compared to January 6th, although this person used the language that, you know, verbatim, that they are still scared, but that there's much more transparency, a lot more intel that's coming through, and a heightened awareness about the potential risks here. You just heard Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby say that U.S. Capitol Police had additionally made a request for reinforcements for these police officers this weekend. So there is at least a recognition and some changes under this new leadership to hopefully prevent something from happening again. But I think what these concurrent investigations are showing us is that there's still so much to be uncovered, and the threat of political violence, as you noted, around the country is still very grave. Congressman Peter Meyer just told me in an interview earlier this week that that was one of his top concerns, that, you know, that it's unlikely that another January 6th exactly is going to happen, but that the threat of political violence in other areas of the country should be of higher concern for his colleagues in Congress, specifically his Republican colleagues.
Miles, George W. Bush on September 11th called domestic terrorists and the threat of domestic extremism the same as the threat from foreign terrorists on and around September 11th. And yet the reality Jackie just described persists. Republicans playing footsie with extremists who are at the intersection of the current threat warning in this country. I wonder if you've revisited some of the things you wrote about first in an op-ed and then in the book Anonymous about efforts, failed efforts, ultimately, to invoke the 25th Amendment.
Well, look, in hindsight, frankly, I think at a minimum in the post-election period, there was probably enough justification for the cabinet members around the president to take action to remove him from office. The fact that his handpicked top military general this week is reported to have, in that time period, tried to put additional safeguards around the nuclear codes and was worried about Donald Trump launching a war potentially with China, is enough to suggest to me that the cabinet probably had reason to consider Donald Trump's removal if he was that mentally unstable. So that, I think, is a major concern. Nicole, to your larger point about domestic extremism, there has been an almost tenfold increase in domestic extremism cases in this country since I was working counterterrorism issues 4 or 5 years ago. And there was a study that came out recently from the University of Chicago that showed that something like 20 million Americans believe that violence is justified to restore Donald Trump to the presidency. 20 million Americans. And of that cohort, 6 million support the idea of militia groups participating in that political violence. These are numbers unlike anything I ever saw when I was in government or in the national security community. That's very concerning. So just exactly as Jackie said, when you've got members of Congress who are fanning the flames of this, the numbers are only going to grow. And I want to be clear about the rally. These people, the folks who are rallying to free, are not political prisoners. They are criminals. They are criminals who stormed the United States Capitol. They are criminals who tried to overturn a legitimate election. They are criminals who injured and in some cases killed law enforcement officers. So the fact that there are some members of Congress cheering them on in the efforts to, you know, free these so-called political prisoners is, to me, a sickening display of moral ineptitude. And at the end of the day, I would say if these members of Congress are playing cops and robbers, in this case, they're choosing to play the role of the robbers. And that is something that we should all have pause about.
Miles Taylor, Jackie Alame, thank you both so much for spending some time with us today. A quick break for us. We'll be right back.
6 years to get this on the first time. I'm so glad it didn't take 6 years to come back. Thank you for getting vaccinated and wearing a mask and supporting live theater.
Makes me cry. It took 18 months, but as of last night, the longest shutdown in Broadway's entire history is over. Sure, some smaller shows restarted a few weeks ago, but now the huge, huge hits are back. We're talking Lion King, Chicago, Wicked, and yes, Hamilton. Some of the biggest contributors to an industry that grossed more than $1.8 billion during its last full season. Those shows are now open to the public. You got to have proof of vaccination and, yes, a mask. Obviously, this doesn't come close to marking the end of the pandemic. We're still far from that. But it's an exciting step back toward what we used to call normal. And that is a very, very good thing. We'll be right back. Oh, thank you for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.